On a Friday, it is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer. Ken, thanks for being here. There is growing evidence that the molecules necessary for life were formed in the space between stars. An astrophysicist and author is teaching kids and adults about our intricate relationship with the entire universe. Ray Jayawardhana is an astronomy professor at Cornell University and dean of the College of Arts and Sciences there. He's written a picture book for kids. It's called Child of the Universe, and he spoke with WPR host Healy Baltina.
In one of the first few pages of your book, a father tells his child, "The universe conspired to make you." What an incredible statement in a world where sometimes we wonder, why am I here?
Indeed, the idea is to inspire a sense of wonder about how we are connected to the rest of the cosmos. So the book really tries to highlight the deep and enduring links between the universe at large and us on this little planet Earth, while also evoking a sense of wonder in kids about the universe beyond and inspiring a sense of grand possibilities for themselves.
Then how do you connect what we know about the physical makeup of the universe to the makeup of our bodies, of our world?
Those connections are real and based on scientific discoveries. To begin with, the long popular idea that we are stardust, that the atoms that make up our bodies and our planet were cooked inside stars that lived and died long ago. So right from that elemental point on, there's so many connections between what we are and what's out there beyond the thin sliver of air that surrounds the Earth. Those connections go obviously a lot far beyond the elements themselves, in that in cold depths of interstellar space, there's growing evidence of more and more complex molecules forging. And there's evidence of asteroids and comets bringing water and other important molecules to the Earth, and perhaps even shaping evolution on our planet through devastating impacts like the one that probably wiped out the dinosaurs.
Sometimes we think about the world existing in the solar system and we don't think very far beyond that, but it's not just our sun. There are so many suns and so much out there. How should we think about that?
Astronomers have identified several thousand worlds beyond our solar system just since the mid-1990s. So we now have some sense of the incredible diversity of worlds out there. And we're beginning to look for evidence of life far beyond Earth. For now, the Earth is the only planet on which for sure we know there is life. But are we alone? That's one of the most profound and fundamental questions about our place in the universe. And we are closer than ever to being able to address that. We don't yet know whether life is common or rare.
Ray Jayawardhana is an astrophysicist and an author. His children's book is a story of love and also science. This is the Ideas Network. Ray, you search out in the universe. Your work can involve telescopes with magnificent power to see things far away. And yet this book is not full of photos from space. It's drawn. It's got bright colors, almost really personal images. Why did you make that choice?
Because the illustrator, Raul Colon, had a vision for the book that captured both the physical and the poetic in, I would say, spectacular ways, you know, together with questions of mystery and complexity about the universe. We also wanted to show the little girl in the book at home in the universe, sense that of grandeur and possibility for herself, but also in turn show that she embodies the universe in the ways that I described a bit earlier.
You include an author's note that we shouldn't think of the universe as out there. Why should we change our perspective?
Because every single second of every day and night, we have trillions and trillions of neutrinos from the sun and beyond passing through our bodies, hardly leaving a trace ever, and yet we are bombarded by particles from beyond. That's just one teeny tiny example of our ongoing connections to the rest of the cosmos. And for another more dramatic reminder is aurorae, northern and southern lights, which are the result of solar flares interacting with the upper reaches of the Earth's atmosphere, reminding us that space weather, as we call it, affects the Earth. And as a technological society, if anything, we are more vulnerable to space weather now than we might have been a couple of hundred years ago, because the GPS system, satellite communications, air traffic, all of that could be affected by a solar storm.
How do you want us to use this book you've written as a conversation starter with our kids or maybe among other adults?
I hope it draws us to think bigger, broader, and more hopeful thoughts. It reminds us of the grandeur of all that's out there and that we're part of it all. That we share a planet with each other and are tied to it in so many ways. And yet our human audacity and reach has brought us far and gives us hope for the future. So I hope at a time of distress and devastation in particular, this book provides a glimmer of positivity, hope, and aspiration.
Has it done that for you?
It certainly has, and I was thrilled to be able to surprise my 6-year-old daughter on her birthday with the first copy of the book.
What did she think?
Oh, she thought it was the coolest thing ever. The real reason for writing the book was to be a cooler dad, of course.
Of course. Makes total sense. Ray, thank you so much for your time today.
Great speaking with you, Keely. Thank you.
That was Cooler Dad, Ray Jeyawardena, talking with WPR host Keely Baltina. His new picture book for kids is called Child of the Universe. Ray is an author and an astrophysicist. He is a professor of astronomy at Cornell University and dean of the College of Arts and Sciences there. Coming up, we learn why clear face masks might be better for childcare providers. Facial expressions are lost behind a mask. What could that mean for kids? We hear from a psychologist when we come back in a moment. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Coming up, we check in with the International Crane Foundation to find out how our world's rarest cranes are doing in these turbulent times. But first, mask wearing is becoming a staple in our lives as public health leaders stress their importance and cities and states put their own rules in place. Face coverings can lower the chances that we spread the coronavirus around, but with that increased safety comes a drawback, especially for young children. They can miss out on important visual cues when they can't see adult faces. Lisa Scott is a researcher and professor of psychology at the University of Florida. She works to understand how infants, children, and adults learn about the visual world. And she spoke with WPR host Keely Voltina.
What do babies learn from looking at adult faces?
Babies learn an enormous amount of information from faces. And so we developmental psychologists, think of faces as a learning tool, just like a book might be a learning tool for babies and children. When you see a face, you see the mouth move, and babies use the mouth to help them learn language and help them sort of discern the difference between different sounds. Babies use the eyes when they're trying to figure out what they need to pay attention to. And when the whole face moves together, they learn about things like emotions and identity of people, especially when people are paired with names.
And how do we actually know that that's how the learning happens?
These studies have been done for decades, and we use multiple methods. One of the traditional methods that is used to understand how babies learn from faces is to just look at how long they look at certain things. So we know that babies tend to like to look at things that are new or novel. And so if you pair two faces together, you would see that they would look longer at the new picture or the novel picture if they can tell the difference between those two. Or if something is highly familiar, like their mother's face, they might look more to their mother's face because it's very familiar. And so we can capitalize on these types of preferences to make inferences about the things that babies might know. So that's one method. The other method that have been used more recently is to use eye tracking. So we can use eye tracking to look at where on a picture babies are attending. If they're looking at the eyes or they're looking at the mouth, we can play videos and see which parts of that video they look at. And then finally, we also use EEG. So we have measures of brain activity. So we place just a little net of recording sensors on their scalp, and we can show them pictures paired with names or labels, pictures of things that they may have learned in a book previously or that they may have seen previously. And then we can compare their brain activity to new things.
So then what do you worry about when it comes to challenges as people are masking up, covering their noses and their mouths to try to stop the spread of disease?
Yes, well, we know that in the home, babies get to see a lot of the mom and fathers and brothers and sisters and all caregivers when they're in the home, and they learn quite a bit from their caregivers that they see quite a bit. That, I think, is important for babies to continue to see those types of faces moving and laughing and expressing and talking. As we start to transition back to sending our kids to daycare and pre-kindergarten and, even school-age kids, covering up the mouth, it leads babies to miss out on visual cues that they would typically get from faces. So when the mouth is moving, you know, babies use that to try and understand language, to try and disambiguate the difference between the sound ba and da, for example, especially in noisy environments or in other types of environments. They really rely on the mouth for language development. When we cover up the mouth, it seems that they're not going to get that information. And that doesn't mean that they won't learn language. Of course, they'll still learn. It's just a little bit harder and taxing for them to do so.
What are our options then? Because you're not suggesting people taking care of small children go without masks.
No. I think that the recommendations from the CDC seem to be very clear in terms of masks, and we should be using masks. But there are some masks that are available and face shields that are available that are clear or transparent. And I think there's a lot of room for innovation in this area. And so what I would suggest is that we start to see whether we can use clear masks that are also safe and protecting the teachers and the children, but that allow infants to see the mouths move. And these are already being used within the deaf and hard of hearing communities. So I think that we recommend that child care facilities and other early learning centers begin to use these masks also.
Lisa Scott is a researcher and professor of psychology at the University of Florida. She studies how infants, children, and adults learn about the visual world. And we're talking about the effect that caregivers wearing face masks could have on babies. This is the Ideas Network. Lisa, I talked with a pediatrician who said masks do cover up much of the face, but he's found he can interact even with a six-month-old well because of eye contact. How crucial is it to see those eyes?
It's very crucial to see the eyes. I think that the eyes provide a huge amount of information. So when I look across the room or I look at something, infants can use my direction of gaze to direct their own attention and learn about something. Or if I'm labeling an object and I look at it, babies might be able to then map that word or that label to the object that I've named when I'm directing my attention. Also, you know, when the eyebrows go up, it's likely that the person is smiling, and you can begin to tell when people have masks on that they're smiling. But it's a slightly different cue. It's kind of a little bit harder to tell with the mask. But I think the eyes are really critical for learning about emotions and intentions and where to direct their own attention. And so, but that's a little bit different from how babies use the mouth, which is for language development.
Clear masks, though, they tend to be more expensive than paper ones or the cloth masks that people are making themselves. How do you want us to think about balancing the actual costs with the benefits that babies could get by figuring something else out?
One of the reasons why I thought that it was important to get this information out is so that there might be some innovation around clear masks that might sort of address some of those issues, because I do think that it's important if we can have clear masks around kids. Of course, you know, if that's not possible, I think they're going to learn just as well. There just might be some delays, and there might be some extra care that teachers and caregivers are going to have to take to make sure that, you know, that the babies are seeing faces and getting that kind of experience.
And you don't want to increase screen time, but that's what popped into my head when you're saying if you can't see it physically and you need to see someone talking, we do have videos, or I guess maybe FaceTime with family members, or more time interacting at home without those masks. Are those things that parents can do?
Yeah, well, I would suggest that the home environment, a lot from live people, is the best way to interact with babies. And, you know, if you just build that into your routine or your schedule to have some time, it's almost like, you know, they suggest that you have tummy time. You could also schedule in some face time where you're just sitting and playing face to face, talking, you know, making facial expressions and playing with infants, and then maybe reading a book to them, or, you know, interacting with them at that level. I think that would be useful regardless of whether they are exposed to masks most of the day or not.
Sure, but also really intentionally doing that, not just talking to your young one when you're making dinner, but also looking at them and talking to them for a longer amount of time than maybe you might normally.
Yes, yeah. I would say that that's important, and that, you know, parents and caregivers can strive to do that normally, but, you know, especially now.
Lisa, thank you for breaking this down for us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Lisa Scott talking with WPR host Keely Boltina. Lisa Scott is a researcher, psychology professor at the University of Florida. We have a link, by the way, to her article on clear face masks. It's at WPR.org/mornings. Coming up, we find out how whooping cranes are doing. Have you seen one in the wild? What do you want to know about their migration and how to protect them? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll have the crane research coordinator from the International Crane Foundation in Baraboo coming up right after this news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. Oh, listen to that. It's the calls of whooping cranes from the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. We're checking in on efforts to protect whooping cranes and their habitat and breeding grounds in Wisconsin. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Whooping cranes were on the verge of extinction back in the 40s, and today there are more than 80 in the International Crane Foundation's headcount of the eastern migratory flock that was raised in captivity and then released. Have you worked with whooping cranes in our state? What do you think needs to be done to help establish a stable population? What is it like to see them in the wild? We're at 800-642-1234. Anne Lacey is the crane research coordinator for the International Crane Foundation in Baraboo. Anne, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Oh, good morning. Thank you so much for the opportunity to talk about whooping cranes.
Oh, yes. How has the pandemic affected your efforts to build the population up and to protect them?
Oh, boy. Well, you know, I have to be optimistic, and we have managed to be okay with one really, really big impact that the pandemic has had on our efforts, and that is that we will not be releasing any captive-reared whooping cranes into Wisconsin this year. And it was not an easy decision, but it actually goes back to March when the International Crane Foundation actually started having all of its staff work at home before the order came down for the state to try to shut down and try to stay safer at home. And so that affected our crane care staff first and foremost. This kind of all comes back to the fact that we have very live, endangered species on our site up here in Baraboo at our headquarters. And that is our priority, keeping them safe. And the people that keep them safe are people. So we kind of stepped back from that. And so we decided we have no idea what's going to happen in the summer and the fall. You know, this was back in March, and none of us knew really what to expect from any of this. And so we had to plan way, way, way ahead. And it was decided to not rear chicks because we decided to keep our staff safe from any potential virus exposure. They split up into two teams that would not overlap. And they even disinfected all equipment between shifts.
Take us into the field, if you could, Anne. How exactly would captive rearing be unsafe for staff?
Well, that happens on our site.
Okay.
So our captive crane staff works very closely. None of our birds are naturally fertile. So that requires artificial insemination. That requires close contact. It requires a lot of staff, and we require interns to help out with our rearing throughout the year. So that's why we had to think way ahead, and so we decided not to bring interns onto our site. And splitting up the staff reduced the staffing on any given day. And so basically what that all boils down to is we really couldn't justify raising birds in captivity for release, which was really tough. And it actually was made in decision with other captive centers. So other places in North America that are have captive whooping cranes are not raising birds for release either. So we have 1 year where we won't release birds for into the population, but we are monitoring them in the field for natural reproduction.
From a research standpoint, that might be an interesting experiment for you that happened naturally.
Yeah. So, and again, you know, the birds don't know that there's a pandemic going on, and they did great. They had, you know, I think that it's great to kind of observe what's happening in the natural world without quite so much disturbance from people happening. They went about their business naturally, and we had 18 chicks that we documented hatching in the wild this year. We know of four that are still alive, and so we're monitoring them as closely as we can, given our restrictions. And so we're really hopeful. And the fact that we're not able to release captive birds is a little blip in the grand scheme of things.
Why is it so difficult to get those chicks to adulthood?
That's a big question that we have. You know, I think that's what it boils down to. What it will take to downlist whooping cranes from endangered to threatened on a continent scale, on a species scale, is more than the natural population that goes down to Texas in the winter and breeds in Canada. And so we need to establish other self-sustaining populations. To do that, we need them to create more of themselves rather than having humans supplement their population. And so that is the biggest stumbling block right now. They are living into adulthood, birds that we place on the landscape. They're pairing, they're laying fertile eggs. And now much of our research concentrates on what is it that is preventing those chicks from fledging, so learning to fly and following their parents on migration. And there is a multitude of things that are against them. And one of them is numbers. They're still fairly rare here in Wisconsin. And with only four fledging a year, that's great if we get that many even this year, but that might not compensate for natural death that happens in the population. So we need more of them, and so that's what we're researching.
We're talking about the pandemic's toll on whooping cranes. Our guide is Anne Lacey. She's Crane Research Coordinator for the International Crane Foundation in Baraboo. You can join in with your questions. What do you want to know about whooping cranes and all cranes? Do you look out for the return of whooping cranes as part of their migration pattern? What did you notice this year? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. And give us a sense of how the numbers, because, you know, there's the world whooping crane population, and then you also have migratory flocks and different populations there. Can you break that down for us?
Right. So in the world, there's not even 800 in the world. A lot of those are in captivity, and that is really our savings account. So our genetic savings account for that species is in captivity, and that really aids in our reintroductions. That population was based on the natural migratory population. Again, I mentioned that goes to the central part of the country, and that is over 500, and that is alone is reason for joy.
And is that the one that kind of connects Louisiana to Wisconsin?
It is not. No,
okay, that's a different one.
That is a population. Yeah, that the natural population, the remnant population, it goes by many names. They breed in Wood Buffalo National Park up in Canada, and they fly down to the Texas coast. And also, as part of the downlisting that I spoke of, right now there's a population here in Wisconsin, of course, that migrates to the southeast-ish, generally. But there's also a non-migratory population that the International Crane Foundation also raises chicks for to contribute to the non-migratory population in Louisiana. And so both of those populations are not yet self-sustaining. And so that is something that we're striving for. That will help the downlisting goal. So right now, those two active reintroductions, the natural population, and there's still some non-migratory whooping cranes in Central Florida from a previous reintroduction attempt.
When do the flocks become stable? When do they reach a point where they are self-sustaining?
Yeah, that's, I mean, we have numbers that we are trying to reach, and they're somewhat arbitrary. 1,000 birds in the natural population and a certain number of breeding pairs. We have that same accounting for our Wisconsin flock. We want to have at least 100 birds, more would be good, and 25 breeding pair. So we have achieved that milestone. But if those 25 pairs don't produce enough chicks to, again, they have to produce more in a year than naturally die every year. And so that's really the kicker. And that is not a hard and fast number. It's one of those, you know it when you see it kind of numbers. And we're just not quite there yet.
Do you have a handle exactly on all of the chicks? Do you have very good accounting mechanisms?
Well, we do what we can. And this year was very, very difficult. We rely on aerial surveillance. And that is the best way to see them. Luckily, they're big white birds. because seeing them from on the ground is difficult in our lush Wisconsin wetlands. Folks that have visited some of the places in Wisconsin where they are can attest to this. Sometimes all of a sudden, bring, they appear. But you have to be up in the air to see them very well. So this year, when we were not allowed to go out and do field work early in April, which is the nesting season, and our pilots were grounded, we just had to wait and see. But the minute we had a plan to go out in the field safely, we did, and we started counting them up. But it was really the air support that is huge to allow us to be able to count chicks. And so we think that we've got them all.
They are just beautiful birds. Can you describe them to us?
Oh, any animal that can look you in the eye kind of engenders respect, right? And whooping cranes are actually a little bit taller than the average human. Sandhills can look me in the eye at about 5'5". Whooping cranes are a little bit bigger. They're bigger bodied. They're bright, bright white. And you only see their black primary feathers when they're flying. And they get up into the air and they fly around with those black wingtips and bright white plumage. And they're gorgeous with the red head as an accent.
We are checking in on whooping crane conservation efforts with Anne Lacey. She coordinates crane research for the International Crane Foundation in Baraboo. Do you look out for the return of the whooping and sandhill cranes as part of their spring migration? What did you see this year? What did you notice? What questions do you have about cranes and efforts to breed them in captivity? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a moment with Anne Lacey right here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the whoopers, as they're sometimes called, here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Whooping cranes were at the brink of extinction in the 40s. Now conservation biologists say there are more than 500 birds. The endangered whooping crane is in recovery. We're checking in on how the pandemic could affect the future stability of the flocks. What do you love about cranes? Where do you go to watch them? What do you want to know about their migration patterns and how they care for their chicks? It's 800-642-1234. Anne Lacey coordinates crane research at the International Crane Foundation, and she stays with us. Let's take a call now. Karen is with us from Black Creek this morning. Hi, Karen.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. What is your question about the whooping cranes?
Well, I was fortunate enough to have a whooping crane sighting near our home. It was about, a year or two ago. My husband and I were coming home from work, and we live way out in the country, and so we were by this big cornfield, and we saw these two big white blobs in the middle of the cornfield, and we were like, what are those? And as we sat and watched them, my husband kept saying, I think those are whooping cranes. And I said, those can't be whooping cranes. They're endangered. There's not that many of them. And so we watched for a while, and we took some pictures, and they flew away. And, oh, my God, when they flew away, they were huge. And we sent the pictures to my niece, who's a huge birder, And she said, "Where are you? Those are whooping cranes. That's like a lifetime bird sighting." And so she told us to report them on the International Crane Foundation site, which we did. But it was really just a stunning sight. It was incredible. And then I just also wanted to comment, I live in the same area where I grew up as a child, and the sandhill cranes have come back innumerably, and they're so pretty to watch, they're so delicate, and their calls are just amazing. So really, that's just what I wanted to share.
Oh, Karen, thank you for sharing such a spectacular event. And what can you add about Karen's sighting?
Oh, that is great. That was a perfect description of what so many people experience when they see whooping cranes, and it is true. But Karen, thank you so much for also mentioning the sandhill crane, Wisconsin's other crane. The sandhill crane is definitely a conservation success story and their comeback. And that is what we hope for the whooping crane. But yeah, never assume if you see whooping cranes out in the wilds of Wisconsin that we know that they're there. And I really encourage folks, if they do see them, to report the sighting like Karen did. You can search for "report a whooping crane," and that our site should come up, but it's on our website at savingcranes.org, and you'll see how to report a whooping crane. Also sandhills. Lots of people do research on sandhills, and you might see colored bands on their legs, and you can report those at the same place.
Do those sightings, that documentation, does that help you in your research?
Absolutely, it does. Yep. That is how we know birds. They have all of Wisconsin and Minnesota and Illinois and Michigan to expand into, and it's their choice. Once we release them or they're raised in the wild, they can choose wherever they'd like to go. And it's a lot of space, and we are few, those of us that are keeping track of them. So, yeah, it absolutely, sometimes they pop up in the most amazing places. Sometimes they might pop up with a chick. Oh, we had no idea you were nesting there. So we really rely on the sightings of folks, especially in the wintering grounds and on migration, too.
What is, actually, let's bring in Nancy now in Middleton. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, thank you for your show. We were, about a year or a little more ago, we were driving County V, I think it is, to the forest, and we happened to see a grouping of sandhill cranes with three whooping cranes, and I believe that some of them are being released with sandhills. We had enough time to go back and get a camera and a tripod and photograph them, got their band numbers, and I first called the federal DNR or whatever, and they told me to call the Sandhill Crane Foundation, which I am a member of, by the way, and they we did, and you were able to tell me exactly by the tag numbers what crane they were, where they were born, everything. It was so cool for the whooping cranes.
How fascinating.
It was really neat. We have some beautiful pictures of them, and people were stopping by the road because they saw us, and one guy said, "Is that an albino sandhill crane?"
Oh, dear. Oh, dear.
No. And I was telling everybody to be really quiet. And I was I was just shaking with excitement. It was so wonderful. And it was great. And I also recommend, there's so many great places to see those sandhill crane migrations. We've been to Kearney, but also Crex Meadows in Wisconsin, of course, the Aldo Leopold Center, too. But it was really neat to see those great big white cranes in with the sandhills as well. So.
Nancy, thank you for sharing that experience. And what is the relationship like between sandhills and whooping cranes?
Well, for the most part, they do share similar habitats. They are both wetland nesters, so they require the beautiful Wisconsin wetlands for nesting. And we have been so blessed with being able to have about 50% of our historic wetlands here in Wisconsin. So there's plenty of nesting area. But they both have adapted to our agricultural landscape. You know, they really like those open areas for foraging, and that's probably where Nancy saw that sighting. And she mentioned that often we will release, if we cannot find an adult whooping crane to release a young captive-reared whooping crane with, that doesn't always work out. We know that we can release the whooping cranes into the company of those beautiful flocks of sandhills, And that will, they'll be able to learn the migration route from their sandhill cousins. And
oh,
it does
wow.
often happen that they're not albino necessarily, but every now and again, there's a very white or light colored sandhill out there. But make no mistake, if you see a whooping crane, you'll know it.
Well, they may just have a foster family that they're working with.
Exactly. Yep. Exactly.
What is parenthood like for whooping cranes?
They are extraordinary parents. So cranes are infamous for pairing for life, more or less. And so the male and the female crane, they set up their pairing at about 3 years old. They start nesting, and it might take them a while to figure out how to raise chicks successfully. But they both take care of incubation duties. They have to sit on eggs for 30 days before they hatch. Whooping cranes take about 100 days before they are fully capable of flight, and so that's a long time to take care of a young, vulnerable bird, and they have to provide it with food and teach it how to find food in these beautiful Wisconsin wetlands that we have that have abundant resources. And so it's really, really intense. And so right now, a lot of our young birds are just learning to fly, and so they have to take them to an open area and kind of encourage them to get up in the air and realize what it's like to have air under the wings. And then the big event comes in about November when the parents will lead it on a great journey to wherever they may winter. And so imagine getting in the car and taking a road trip with mom and dad to some place you might never have been. And that's what the fall will entail for the birds before they are released on their own and the parents come back to nest and they are on their own in the wild.
And what can we do for these birds in the wild, these endangered birds? How can we help them with their nesting spaces, with trying to grow and prosper?
Well, in the wild, I think Nancy hit it. Respect birds that you see out in the wild. Stay in your car. Don't approach them. You might find that they don't mind if you approach them, but that is not a good idea for sandhills or whooping cranes. So give them space and don't disturb them. To support the Crane Foundation's efforts, thank you, Nancy, for being a member. That's fantastic. Membership is great. We have many programs at the International Crane Foundation for endangered cranes and saving the places where they live. Supporting people in crane places so that they don't disturb the cranes, and this is happening worldwide. So we have lots of information about our programs and special events coming up next week. We have Whoop It Up, very appropriate for our talk today. Whoop It Up is our big event for this year, and that's next Thursday, and you can find out much more about that at savingcranes.org.
Well, Anne, thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Anne Lacey is the Crane Research Coordinator for the International Crane Foundation in Baraboo. And for disclosure, it is a business sponsor of WPR. Just ahead, we have Dan Sachs from the Noodle Loaf podcast for another Explorers Club Hour. Dan is a music teacher. We'll share his ideas for creative fun. Stay with us. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.